Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, I just found out that I'm colorblind.
Really?
Paul, it came out of the purple.
Oh, we're not even going with a theme now?
I've just given up on the theme. It's kind of medical related.
So, Matt, I'm not sure if you heard, but oxygen actually went out on a date with potassium.
Okay.
It went okay. But then, Matt, then okay. Oxygen went out on a date with magnesium. And people were like, OMG.
Those are pretty good, Paul.
Yeah, no, I slaved over. I mean, meanwhile, you're giving me this colorblind nonsense. I'm not quite sure what we're doing here anymore.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly CashLack Memorial Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Franquato, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, maybe even the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well. We have a wonderful show tonight. We had with us Susan Jacobs, who taught us all about hypoxemia, prescribing oxygen, which is something that has confused me, Paul, because there's so many different options. And we really needed a great team to help us with this. You're going to tell us about our other co-host in a second. But first, Paul, what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. We are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews for new clinical roles and practice-changing knowledge. And in addition to the expert that we had in Susan Jacobs, we are also joined by producer, writer, and our resident pulmonologist, Dr. Leah Witt, who helped put this episode together and helped guide us through what, as you mentioned, is sort of a bewildering topic, or at least was prior to this episode for me. Leah, how are you?
I'm great. Hi, Paul. Hi, Watto. So we talked to Susan Jacobs. She's an incredible expert nurse who received her graduate degree in pulmonary nursing from the University of California, San Francisco. She has a nursing background that includes so many roles: clinical care nurse educator, NIH project director for dystonia exercise, and coordinator of pulmonary rehab program. Currently, she's the research nurse manager in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Stanford. She's been with the ILD program since its inception in 2004, and her focus is on symptom management and quality of life for these patients. She coordinates research projects, ILD support groups. There's nothing she doesn't do for patients with ILD. And we're going to talk to her tonight because she was the lead author on key oxygen publications, including an ATS guideline about oxygen prescribing. So check out that American Thoracic Society workshop report, and we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of when to prescribe, why to prescribe, and what you actually are ordering when you're ordering oxygen. So let's get into it.
A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And if you haven't done so yet, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get twice monthly bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, access to our Discord server, CashLack Vault, a whole bunch of other cool stuff. patreon.com/curbsiders. Susan, thank you so much for joining us. And before we get into talking about oxygen, the audience wants to know, what's a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine?
Well, I thought about this for a while. And you know, hobbies for me have changed a lot over the years. So right now, my current hobby is carving out time for grandchildren and travel. But I want to be clear that they don't go together. I'm not looking at traveling with my grandchildren. I don't know if my children are listening, but they are lovely, but young and wild, and not enough time I have to spend with them. So those are my current two goals and hobbies.
I think it's smart to separate the two, I have to say.
For now, yes.
Yeah, hard agree. As someone who just came back from a camping trip with a 3 and 1 year old, do not recommend. A little too young. I'll ask you, what is your favorite failure? And what did you learn from that failure?
I had a nice failure very early in my career as a pulmonary nurse specialist. It was the first role I had taken. And I was a nursing educator on a cardiac surgery intensive care unit. And I had this great idea of having a resource manual in every room. We had separate rooms. It wasn't an open unit. So there was a nurse committee. I tried to get them to meet. It was after work. I just couldn't get buy-in. The project never moved along very rapidly. By the time I got a draft, it was already outdated with some of the resources. And it was a great idea that just failed, as they say, died on the vine. And I really learned from that about engagement, buy-in, delegating, and timelines, kind of tangible outcomes, and just, you know, motivating a group and keeping that project moving forward. And this one failed miserably. My successor actually was able to somehow launch it much better than I did. So I've always learned from that when I take on projects or, you know, any personally or professionally, that project management is a very important skill.
It seems like you've overcome that initial failure with some of the things you've accomplished. So I'm sure you're very good at project management at this point.
It's an ongoing growth skill for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Paul, anything else before we get on to the case?
Sure. I'll ask our usual is, do you have any advice that you often give learners or advice that you've received that has been especially helpful for you?
Again, it was very early in my career, I was in graduate school. And I actually spent 3 months with a renowned pulmonary nurse specialist who trained at the Brompton's Hospital in London. And we were rounding, and I was a new pulmonary nurse, and she was troubleshooting some chest tubes in a patient's room and talking to the nurse, and told the nurse that she would provide her some information. And we left the room, and she turned to me and she said, "Whenever I say I'm going to do something, I do it." And she said, "Remember that." And I was, you know, and that sticks with me to this day, because when the words come out of my mouth saying, "Okay, I'm going to fill in the blank, send you this, get back to you on this," you know, I strive to make good on that statement. So that was good advice that I've really never forgotten. Still working on it, but
that's why I commit to very little, but that is excellent advice.
I think everybody, especially on like the inpatient side, is very guilty of saying you will do something and intending to do it, but it just doesn't happen, because if you don't immediately write it down or...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's good. I like that one.
All right. So our first case is James. He's an 80-year-old man with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis diagnosed 2 years ago. He comes to see you for an urgent visit for increasing shortness of breath. In the last 3 months, he's noted progressive dyspnea and cough, particularly in the evening. He checks his oxygen saturation at home and is noticing that his saturation drops quickly with any activity. Today in the office, his resting saturation is 87% and quickly drops to 79% with a short walk. Your clinic nurse walks with James around the clinic for 3 minutes in order to assess his oxygenation and titrate supplemental oxygen. At the end, at his nadir, he requires 5 liters per minute of supplemental oxygen to keep his saturation over 90%. So, Susan, I'd like to start by asking you, what does the first office visit look like for somebody with newly diagnosed hypoxemia or a new oxygen need?
So it's a very critical visit, obviously. The first thing I think we need to realize is a huge life change for this patient, being told they have a need for oxygen, especially in this case. This gentleman has resting hypoxemia, so he's going to get oxygen for the first time prescribed 24 hours a day. And that's a real jolt. You know, typically we would see a patient that the first time they need oxygen is with exertion only, but this gentleman arrives with more advanced disease. So it's a lot of education, and our guidelines support this, of providing written resources to the patient. And the first step is really going through the different types of oxygen. So we go through the fact that he's going to receive a stationary device and a portable device. And the choices are either a gaseous in a canister, a metal cylinder, or it could be in a portable oxygen concentrator that takes oxygen out of the room air and extracts it, purifies it, spits it out to him, or liquid. Now, liquid oxygen is extremely rare right now for a variety of reasons, mostly driven by financial reimbursement changes. But liquid oxygen is provided in the home also in a large reservoir, and the patient can take a portable canister and fill their portable device. So there's a lot of ways we can go here, but in this educational time with this patient, the first thing to understand is his level of oxygen need, which has been titrated and needs 5 liters of continuous flow, no portable oxygen concentrator can provide that. So that's the first lifestyle change for this patient is because we don't have a liquid canister that's small and compact to offer them at high flow, that his only option will be the metal tanks, like an E-tank, which is, you know, 18 pounds to him to pull around, lift in and out of a car. And at 5 liters continuous flow, that E-tank, maybe, you know, 3 hours, 2 to 3 hours. So there's education on the equipment that he's going to be delivered. And in this case, we will be saying to this gentleman, you're going to be receiving some E-tanks. And then we will also be providing a stationary concentrator for the use in your home, plugged into the wall.
I was going to say for the audience, because I had never heard of, looking at the ATS guidelines, the first time I really heard of this, like A, B, C, D, and E tank. So E tank is just that taller, is it like 3 feet tall tank that the patient would have on the two wheels, right? And then there's the smaller tank is the B tank that you might see them carrying around when they go out to doctor's visits. It might hang around their neck or something.
Yes. Okay. I mean, it's hard because there's a lot of education here to go through equipment, but I can clarify that.
Oh yeah. No, but I think that's for the audience, basically like the A letter would be the smallest tank and the E is a bigger tank and it's 26 inches tall, something like that.
Yes.
Okay.
So this gentleman, unfortunately, could not have one of those nice small portable tanks because some of these compressed gas tanks, you're right, can be over the shoulder. Some are as big as a wine bottle. In this case, needing 5 liters a minute, he'll need the E-tank, which is about three feet tall. And he'll need to be provided a number of them. So his portability, one of the important things as a prescriber is to determine how often is this gentleman out of the house? How mobile is he? Is he caring for a spouse? Is he need to take her to doctor appointments? Is he going to pulmonary rehab twice a week? Is he still working? You just don't know. So it's important to assess that. And then things like, does he have stairs? Is this a person who has to go up, you know, 20 stairs? So there's a lot of issues for this gentleman, and he's very classic with IPF, already needing high flow. And this is a huge impact on his mobility. But we do also want to give him enough tanks. And we can talk about that more when we get into the actual prescriptions. But the equipment for him and the education will be around managing the stationary concentrator. It will plug in. It needs electricity. It comes either as a regular concentrator, like 1 to 5 liters per minute, and it's continuous flow. Or it may be a high flow concentrator. If he were to need more, that would go 6 to 10. It has a 25 to 50 foot cord. So you need to provide education about tripping, safety. This concentrator can't be shut in a tiny closet against the wall. It needs to breathe and have air around it. It'll overheat. We just had an instance of a patient not getting oxygen and having unknown reasons for saturations dropping in the home. And his filter was completely clogged. He had never been instructed to take out the filter and change it. So, and his wife was a retired ICU nurse and figured this out.
just headed for bronchoscopy because of a dirty filter.
Yeah. Basic care of the equipment. And this is an expectation and a standard that, again, our guidelines support that every patient, when they're provided a first-time equipment, that they're instructed on how to use that stationary concentrator, how to, you know, make sure it's working. He may need a humidifier ordered as well. He's at semi-high flow. Avoid nasal dryness, nosebleeds, those kinds of complications. And then taking care of that humidifier, so he's not, you know, getting contamination, infection.
Hey, esteemed medical professionals, are you seeking to elevate your career within a distinguished academic environment? Well, the University of Virginia is the place for you because they have a renowned academic general internal medicine team. Their institution is celebrated for its excellence in patient care, cutting-edge research, and exemplary teaching. You're going to collaborate with some of the most brilliant minds in medicine and contribute to pioneering research that's going to help shape the future of healthcare. As a member of their team, you're going to thrive in an intellectually stimulating and supportive environment, and there's abundant opportunities for professional development. Plus, you get to live in the beautiful city of Charlottesville. There's a lot of culture. There's a lot of picturesque scenery. You'll love it. They even have jobs that are 100% outpatient and located right near Charlottesville, offering that perfect balance between professional fulfillment and quality of life. And they're proud to be eligible for public service loan forgiveness. So what are you waiting for? This is your moment to advance your career and make a profound impact on the field of medicine. Visit uvahealth.com to explore this exceptional opportunity and submit your application today. That's uvahealth.com, the University of Virginia, where your professional aspirations and contributions to healthcare excellence will flourish. Apply now. This episode is brought to you by Beginly Health, the job matching platform for every physician and advanced practice clinician. Tired of recruiters calling and texting you nonstop, wondering if that salary offer is competitive, or do you just want to find the right job without fear of your personal info being leaked to the internet? Beginly Health gets it. You want control over your job search, your information, and ultimately your future, and you should. That's why Beginly Health created a new and better experience for job seekers that confidentially matches you with jobs you're actually interested in, and recruiters and employers can't access your info until you decide to share it with them. Whether you value salary or a specific living location, Beginly's matching algorithm weeds out the noise and helps you find the perfect match. Their platform takes your personal, professional, and location preferences into account and then continuously works for you in the background to present jobs and employers that match what you're looking for. And it's completely free for you. Ready to take control of your job search? Visit beginlyhealth.com/curbsiders. That's beginlyhealth.com/curbsiders to get started. Beginly Health, powered by preference, connected by passion. Susan, can I ask Paul a question? Paul, are you getting nervous now that you're not that you weren't aware of all these things and aren't counseling people about all these things?
Let me ask the question a different way. So, Susan, thank you, Matt, for raising that. I was going to ask one of my patented Paul Williams fundamental dumb questions, but I guess what is the context in which the patient is getting this education? Like, is the expectation that the primary care doctor will be going through this? Does this happen? Is there a nurse that works at the medical supply company? Should this be happening prior to How does this initial visit look like for most patients? Because I imagine there's some variability for it.
You're exactly right. So we can take the spectrum. If you're in an academic medical center and you have a large specialty clinic, like an interstitial lung disease clinic, for example, and this patient comes there, the expectation would be he'd be handed a new patient packet, or if he wasn't a new patient, an oxygen packet. So he's got written information. Included would be links to videos, because there's many foundations with outstanding videos showing how to set this up, how to use it, explaining the differences. And a nurse would likely hand that to him and go over the equipment and the plan and assist them in picking a DME, a durable medical equipment company, and identifying if that company has the equipment that they need. So in that setting, it's about as good as it gets, right? You've got a nurse giving education. Elsewhere, so you go out in the community, rural, primary care, non-specialty care, they're not getting this. And so their education comes from the truck driver. And in our publication of our patient perceptions and patient experiences with oxygen, it was about 2,000 patients, over half reported problems, and 70% reported they got their education from their DME delivery driver. And I'm not dissing those drivers. They do a great job. And then many patients, it's simply delivered, and there's nothing. They're left to figure it out on their own. So it's a huge gap that we try and address. There's great information and resources there, but it's getting it out to those physicians and patients.
Susan, are the DME companies required to give any clinical education to the patients about the equipment, or do they expect that the referring provider does it all?
They are expected to train the patient on the operation of the equipment. That could be very short, and then handing the patient and their family member, remember this impacts the whole family, a pretty technical, you know, equipment instruction booklet. I wouldn't say particularly user-friendly. But again, there's a spectrum. Some patients will report to us, the equipment was dropped off, there's nothing. Others rave about their delivery person, comes in, checks equipment. But the majority do not get the education they need. I mean, you can imagine in the first visit, right? It's just like telling the patient a new diagnosis. They're not hearing everything. Right. They're thinking of the stigma, of this cannula on their face, of what their family and friends are going to think. Can I go to church? Is it going to make noise? Can I travel? Can I still go? You know, yeah. So there's a lot going through their head and the absorption's challenging.
We have jumped ahead like we often do, but I'm wondering if we could take a step back. And before the oxygen is delivered, how are you ordering the prescription? Like, what actually needs to be documented? And can it be done only in person, in video? Do you have to walk someone a certain amount of time? Like, what are the actual logistics and requirements for insurance coverage?
So there are a few things. So the patient qualifies with some documentation of a walking or activity test. It doesn't have to be a formal 6-minute walk, which is a timed, you know, very formal test, but it can just be what we call, you know, oximetry, oxygen titration, oxygen testing, where you can have the medical assistant, the physician, the nurse, you know, RT, whoever's in the clinic, walk the patient in the hallway with a pulse oximeter. They need to document that that patient hits 88%. Or below, and then Medicare will pay for that equipment. But that's just one step. So the patient desaturates, meets that mark, then you need to know how much oxygen it takes to get them, and we would say over 90%. And some other populations may want a narrow range, like 90 to 92%. So you have to walk the patient again on oxygen. So this gentleman we just talked about needs 5 liters. So that was probably walking them first on 2, not making it, stop, rest, up to, we'd usually go up by 2 liters in increments. Some may go up by 1. You go to 4, it's still not above 90. You go to 6. Now, Medicare was requiring if you had a patient that needed 6 liters of oxygen or anything above 4, you had to document in your order that they desaturated below that 88% on 4 as well. And then you would go up to 6. So this gentleman was at 5, and that's where he is for exertion. And I that's for the exertion. Now, we kind of skipped how much did he need at rest, right? This gentleman was at 87%, as I recall, at rest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Good so point. They first needed to titrate him while he was sitting.
Mm-hmm.
So your oxygen order needs that documentation, first of the diagnosis or the disease that's needing the oxygen. And then a actual document saying desaturation below, you know, at, you know, an 88% on room air. And then you would say, you know, 88%, or you could even, like this gentleman was probably 82% on room air, 85% on 2, not much better on 4, but on 5, he was 90%. So that has to be documented in the note. Mm-hmm. And then you need to document, what you're going to give, how often they're to use that. So if we have another patient example that might be exertion only, for this gentleman, your order would say he should be using it 24 hours a day.
Right, because he is resting. Someone who's resting SAT is 88% or below. Okay.
Yes. He's 87% at rest.
Yeah. And I was going to say, you said that they really want you to do that extra documentation if they're going to need 6 liters. Is that because the standard oxygen concentrator is 1 to 5 liters per minute? So they would need a high flow concentrator. I imagine that might be more expensive, and whatever equipment they need is going to be different than if they need 6 liters or more than if they need 5 liters or less.
Some of it's just documentation that when you hit that 4 liters, they want to document that at 4, they still desaturate that 88% or below. But you are correct, when they hit five or six, they need a different concentrator. And not all DMEs have them readily available. That's another whole nother topic, what kind of equipment they have available. But this gentleman, you know, he's going to need oxygen all the time. So your order is 24 hours at what liter flow? So the order will say, let's just say 3 liters per minute at rest and 5 liters per minute with exertion. And then you need a sleep. And that's, you know, varies, I think, by practitioner. You can do overnight pulse oximetry. That's not a sleep study. That's not for obstructive. It's just plain old pulse oximetry if you really want it accurate, but that's not titrating. But in a gentleman like this, a provider might choose to, if at rest or exertion, he's needing 3 to 5. At sleep, they would just assume at least 3 because that's what he needs at rest and maybe a little more at sleep. I don't know, Leah, you can weigh in on that, but that's a little bit of a gray zone. I don't know the data on sleep.
That's one of the questions we have, Leah, definitely about sleep, because, you know, people, especially even if they just get a sleep study and they see that they're desatting, you know, people really are like, oh, I need oxygen, right? You know, so how do you talk to people about that?
Yeah, if they're only desaturating with sleep, that's a different topic. I mean, then mm-hmm. I would have to, that's rarely prescribed. Unless there's really clinical indications, especially along with obstructive sleep apnea, that makes it, that's different. That does qualify.
Yeah, this is totally a gray zone. And I was just thinking about when do I order overnight oxygen oximetry? And it really varies. In this patient, I would say I would do just what Susan recommended, which is start at 3 liters per minute at night. And then I don't know if I suspected there was some sleep disordered breathing, I would try for an overnight sleep study and make sure I'm ruling out sleep apnea before I'm moving to just bumping up oxygen. But maybe if somebody's waking up with morning headaches or it seems like they're desaturating really quickly when they're walking, then maybe I would do it. But really, we don't have good guidelines and it's kind of just gestalt. I probably order the overnight oximetry studies more when somebody's not on daytime oxygen and they don't have sleep apnea and I think they might be desaturating at night.
Can we stick with that case for a second then? So if you're worried about someone desatting at night, that usually comes up in the hospital. I don't know as an outpatient. Paul, have you ordered that on outpatients before? I hadn't really.
No, because I'm not sure what I would do with it necessarily.
Yeah, I agree. That's a rare. I think that's the more rare. I think the patient, oftentimes, if we have a patient with exertion only hypoxemia, there is data that is highly suggestive of desaturation during sleep. So that patient might benefit from it at night. But again, I don't want to state but I do know that there is some correlation between patients who desaturate with exertion may likely desaturate with sleep. That's just,
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I can put this in the show notes. There was a New England Journal paper from Lacoste in 2020 that looked at a randomized trial of nocturnal oxygen and COPD. And it was unfortunately underpowered. I feel like a lot of these studies that were published in those high impact journals were negative studies. And the two groups were patients with COPD, no sleep apnea, with nocturnal only hypoxemia. And one group got nocturnal O2, one group didn't, and there was no difference in exacerbations or quality of life, but they couldn't, it was underpowered for mortality. So I feel like the evidence is not very strong, but the evidence is not very strong either in exertional hypoxemia, which we're going to talk about next. And I guess evidence, what are you talking about? Like a mortality benefit really is the main thing I'm talking about. So.
And Leah, the NOT trial, just to remind people, this was from 1980. What did that tell us?
Yeah, I would love to hear how Susan talks about the benefit of oxygen to patients. What I usually say, I'll tell you what I say and I'll hear what you say. For this patient, it feels very clear you will have a mortality benefit. You know, we expect that using oxygen will prolong your life. Oxygen is critical for important organs like your brain and your heart. We're especially worried about the development of pulmonary hypertension from low oxygen levels. I've seen many patients with cognitive impairment from hypoxemia. And the NOT trial that you just mentioned from 1980 showed 203 hypoxemic COPD patients, and they had severe hypoxemia and definitely showed a mortality benefit for severe hypoxemia. So that's how I explain it to patients.
No, exactly the same. I mean, it goes in the MRC trial was a similar one. So it's you know, it's very telling that we have the only evidence from 1980 and 81 about the, and it was the COPD patients, and they were a bit sicker, but it was a very clear outcome of mortality benefit. Mm-hmm. So this is the easiest population of patient to really have a really data-driven discussion with them. And it leads to discussing the impact on the heart and right heart failure and pulmonary hypertension, mm-hmm. a little bit of anatomy, ankle swelling. So it is the easiest population. And in the guidelines, it was a strong recommendation, but with only conditional evidence because we don't have it in ILD patients. So we really extrapolated the COPD data to the ILD population. Mm-hmm. So this is the easiest, most data-driven, evidence-based, even though it's not in this patient population. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other piece of that order, because I know you don't want to get the orders wrong, because they'll get sent back to you, is how long is this order for? And it's lifetime. So you'll have two choices, like 6 months or lifetime. So it's the duration of need. You'll check a box. And the other things that you can advocate for this gentleman, if he's out of the house a lot and needs high flow, you can include in your notes, please provide enough portable e-tanks for patient to be out of the house 16 hours a week. You know, patient works, patient needs to care for, patient taking, whatever. And I say this with this gentleman, but there are a lot of young patients on high flow oxygen. You can't forget about them. There are patients with pulmonary hypertension, LAM, a rare lung disease in women. Our IPF patients are often in their 60s, peak of a career, traveling. So you can't forget about mobility in high flow. Sometimes we think of high flow as older and end stage, but high flow can be younger and very active. Mm-hmm.
So the E-tank, like we said, that's the 26-inch tank that generally you have it on that device with the two wheels. Is there any other portable option for someone that needs high flow, like the liquid oxygen or the portable oxygen concentrator? I know those are more expensive or harder to get, but are there any other options for people?
So this is a very good topic because portable oxygen concentrators are the smaller devices. You see a lot of advertising and you see patients using them out and about, like a purse size, you know, varies from 2.5 pounds of the smallest one to, you know, maybe 7 or 8, but then there's some larger ones. These portable oxygen concentrators have settings on them, numeric settings. A lot of them are 1 to 4. Some go all the way up to 6 to 9. The setting is not liters per minute. And this is a profound area of confusion among patients and clinicians.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I knew this until fellowship. I was totally misprescribing portable oxygen concentrators.
I'm so angry right now.
I'm learning it right now.
So this is on pulse flow. So pulse flow, or on demand, is the mode of delivery where the oxygen is only delivered during the inspiratory phase. So they inhale, it triggers it, and they get a bolus of oxygen. There's no portable oxygen concentrator that I know of on the market today, and there's some published lists of these, that deliver more than 2 liters per minute total. Now, some patients who need 2 to 4 continuous flow liters per minute on their walk, let's say, and get a portable oxygen concentrator, they may be fine on that. Again, it's very patient dependent. You have to test the patient on that equipment with a pulse oximeter. It's the only way you're going to know. But when you tend to get patients who are above 3 liters continuous flow, or 4 or 5, certainly 6, 5 and 6, a POC, as we call them, portable oxygen concentrator, will not have adequate delivery amount. And the other thing to understand, in general, we tell patients the smaller the POC, the less delivery power it has. The higher the number setting on it, the faster it goes through a battery. These things can be plugged in and recharged, but they use a battery. And the battery life will be shorter, the higher their respiratory rate and the higher their number setting. So we really try and educate them that the bottom line is their pulse oximetry And we do include that in that education with the patient when they're prescribing oxygen. We do want them to purchase a pulse oximeter. And to use that, we don't want them like married to it all the time. Some patients get too focused. But we do want to know their normals. You know, they can say, well, normally when I do my daily walk around the block on 2 liters, my sats are 94%. And I've noticed for the last week, I'm more breathless. And now when I walk around the block, my sats are 87% on 2 liters. That's very important data for the clinician to know. And I educate patients to think that way. If they call and they say, oh, I'm really more short of breath. Well, what's your oxygen saturation? And then they'll say, oh, I've just been turning it up and I'm running out of tanks. This is another pearl. If they increase in their oxygen needs, the clinician needs to write a new prescription. You can't just call the DME and say, can you give me 10 more E-tanks? Because now I'm needing 6 liters a minute. They will not fill that. They need a new prescription. So the pulse versus continuous flow is an ongoing challenge. Mm-hmm. And there's the Primary Ciliary Dyskinesia Foundation on their website has a wonderful pamphlet that really gives detailed information on all sorts of portable oxygen concentrators and what they deliver. Now, there are maybe 2 portable oxygen concentrators that actually you can switch them to continuous flow, and they go to 3 liters continuous flow per minute. However, they weigh about 18 to 20 pounds, and they need a trolley. So the one important thing about portable oxygen concentrators, it's the only portable oxygen device that the FAA allows on an airplane. So there is some benefit to dragging that big one at 3 liters continuous, because you could take it on an airplane. And that's a whole nother, we'll talk about travel, I think, later. But portable oxygen concentrators are wonderful for a very large population. But if you're a high flow user, it's very important to educate that patient. And what we find is that some patients, so Medicare only gives you one type of portable system. So if they provide you an E-tank, they won't also give you a POC, for example. So some patients, the POC would be great for like eating at your relative's house, just chilling at a restaurant, right? We call it like the shopping oxygen. But when we really want patients to exert themselves or they have to exert themselves, it won't supply. So some patients will buy them out of pocket. And these are $2,000 to $4,000.
Yeah, that's what I've seen quite frequently. Many patients don't want to give them up even after their oxygen needs have outstripped a POC because they're so portable. And people will buy them out of pocket just so they can sit in a car on a portable, which is sort of on the border for that, just sitting with a portable. And then obviously the second he moves, he would desaturate. But people really, that transition away from POCs is really hard for people.
So the other piece of the order, when we talk about pulse and like conserving oxygen, so those tanks can last longer, you can put an oxygen conserving device regulator on the metal gas tanks, the canisters, and you can you can switch it between the two modes. It can go to pulse. So it does help these tanks last longer. So the patient, for example, might turn it to 6 when they're walking or whatever they need. And then they could switch it back and turn it down when they're sitting and maybe even go to pulse to let that tank last longer. And again, the clinician order would have to include okay to use oxygen conserving device or something to that effect.
Okay, I see. So I'm looking at some of the slides that Leah had shared with us. So there's a something that you sort of twist on the top of the the tank that then allows it to pulse the way that a portable oxygen concentrator would.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Because otherwise, if you just put the tubing right up to the tank, like I'm used to seeing, and turn it on, it's continuous flow.
Continuous flow.
Okay. All right.
So we should talk about liquid, though.
Yeah, because you said the E-tank can be turned to high flow, right? It'll just run out faster. And it sounds like the portable oxygen concentrator is not capable of high flow. But what about this liquid oxygen, which is, I hadn't really thought about this, or I don't know if I knew about this, Paul.
Yeah, is anybody able to get it? I haven't seen it in years.
Rare, very rare. The Veterans Hospitals, actually, some have access to it, and there are occasional patients. But liquid oxygen it's just super cooled down. So the basic premise is that that canister holds a much larger volume of oxygen than, for example, an E-tank or even the smaller tanks can hold. So that's the basic advantage of liquid. It's a lot more oxygen and a much lighter capacity, 9 pounds, and, you know, that could last you 6 hours versus 18 pounds. It would last you, or maybe not 6 hours, but the weight and the capacity is a huge advantage of liquid. Liquid, I don't want to date myself, but when I started in pulmonary rehab and had a, run a program locally in the Bay Area, we had a large reservoir. Patients came in with their liquid canisters. You know, they'd fill up when they got there. Those canisters can go up to 10, 15 liters a minute, continuous flow. And then before they left, they would just click on there and fill again. They had a reservoir at home. The change with liquid access came really with a change in the model of reimbursement to durable medical equipment companies. And that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
But it really, the reimbursement went down. I mean, there was an effort to control some fraud. This is back around 2010. Control costs, cost savings in Medicare, but it ended up a bit of an overcorrection. And so the DMEs had a lower reimbursement rate, and liquid oxygen is very expensive to provide to patients. And the main reason is they need special tanks. So these are all, you know, certified special tanks that carry the liquid oxygen. You saw a lot of this during COVID. You saw these delivery tanks going to hospitals, and they need to be delivered every week. So you need a driver to take the tank, the truck, go to the home, refill the reservoir. So that is a large cost to a DME. You know, if you can set up a patient with a concentrator and a home fill unit, we didn't talk about this, the little unit you plop on top of that stationary concentrator in the home, you can actually put some of these C and D tanks, not an E tank, a little smaller than an E tank, but the patients can actually fill their own compressed gas tanks at home. So that DME never has to go to that patient's home again. I mean, they do go out to service equipment, but it decreases their cost. So liquid was very expensive and quickly was phased out by many DMEs. And so now we really don't have that access. And this is part of a large legislative effort that I can talk about at the end to get some reimbursement, difference in language, and change the some legislative rulings to allow liquid for a subset of patients. Not every patient needs liquid. They need to be mobile outside the home and need high flow. And those patients, liquid is perfect.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. And people, I have to say, I love technology. I love being an early adopter. And I have to say, if you're in primary care, you need to be using Freed because it just transforms how you see your patients. It listens and it's going to write the notes, even writes patient instructions while you're in the room, talking to the patient and seeing the patient. You're spending too much time at night writing your notes. You're probably spending too much time away from your family. You need to use this technology so that you can get that time back. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe would, and it will not quit on you. It's already loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It's HIPAA compliant. It takes 30 seconds to learn, and it costs only $99 per month, and your time is worth so much more than that. You can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of the Curbsiders can use the code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. That's freed.ai and use the code CURB50 for $50 off your first month. freed.ai.
So Susan, how is oxygen paid for? What's the out-of-pocket cost for a patient? And I'm also cognizant, since I live in a very expensive state, of electricity bills, and how does that play a role in the oxygen use as well?
So I can't comment on the exact bills that patients are receiving, but I can tell you the payment arrangement. So Medicare establishes a 5-year contract with that patient. So when the patient starts with a DME. They will actually, the equipment is rented for the first 36 months, and they pay, I think, 20% of their, of what's the approved Medicare amount. And I don't want to quote dollar amounts because it varies. And some patients have a supplement that can help with that 20% as well. So they actually have a better coverage. The years 4 and 5, the patient still gets service from the DME, but they're no longer paying that rental fee. But they are expected to have their equipment working and serviced, and they may be charged when the DME comes out to service it or do some repairs. But it's a 5-year contract with the first 3 years paying that rental fee. Now, that's just for their equipment. Patients do pay out of pocket themselves for extra things. For example, an extra battery for their portable oxygen concentrator so they can be out of the house longer. Or they may pay for an extra stationary concentrator because they have a 2-story house and they need to have one up and downstairs. Or maybe they work and they want one in their office, and Medicare won't pay for a second stationary concentrator. So those are the main payments that are coming from the patient in terms of cost.
In our state, we both live in California, you can fill out a form for a patient that they have a life-sustaining device. I can't speak to other states. Paul and Watto, I don't know if you have ever filled one of these out for you.
Once in a while, you get patients asking you, you know, their power is going to be turned off and you need to fill out a medical necessity form.
Yeah. In our state, it's also to help reduce the cost of their electric bills and also keep track of the fact that they're on a life-sustaining device. So I wonder if we should move to case two. I want to talk about an area with a lot of clinical uncertainty. So case two is Betty. She's a 72-year-old woman with COPD who comes to see you for a discharge follow-up. She was hospitalized 2 months ago for a COPD exacerbation due to COVID. Today, she's still not back to normal. She's more short of breath, including with her ADLs, bathing and dressing. At rest, she's 92%. With brief ambulation, she desaturates to 87%. When you really push her on a walk, she's walking a little faster. The lowest she gets is 85%. So with 2 liters of a supplemental oxygen, she gets to 93%. And you also get an overnight oxygen study and see that her oxygen saturation is below 88% for 15 minutes. So she has ambulatory hypoxemia only, which I believe you call moderate hypoxemia in your guidelines. And I'd love to know from you, what's the evidence for using oxygen? Maybe we can talk about what the guidelines say to do, and then we can talk about pros and cons in the situation.
So in the guidelines, we actually refer, a moderate was 89 to 93, which would not qualify a patient for oxygen. So severe was 88 or below. So this woman, Betty, would qualify for oxygen with exertion, but not at rest. And it'd probably use it with sleep as well. She's actually a perfect patient for a portable oxygen concentrator. So this woman is 72. I would say she's young. So she's, but we don't know her, you know, frailty. You know, 72-year-olds can vary, as we know. But she would benefit from a portable oxygen concentrator and then a stationary concentrator for use in the home with exertion. You know, some patients have a treadmill or a stationary bike and they actually do their exercise within the home. So she could increase her stationary concentrator and meet those needs. And then with sleep, you know, the guidelines for moderate hypoxemia did not recommend. They recommend against it. So as we know with exertional hypoxemia, the evidence is much more scarce. So in our guidelines, we made a moderate conditional recommendation with low quality evidence. So this patient, you know, I think there's a lot of counseling here. And again, the guidelines talk about what we call shared decision-making. Patients vary in their response to the benefit of oxygen. We have to advise them that this is not going to take away their breathlessness. It will reverse their hypoxemia. It may increase their exercise capacity, their ability to do more. It may help their breathlessness. It's very important to manage those expectations early on. So, and she would be somebody that we would want to make sure, you know, does she have stairs or tripping in the house? She'll have that, the concentrator in the house, but really only for sleep, unless she also exercises. But there's a lot of clinical uncertainty around the use of oxygen in exertion only, especially this is not significant. I mean, 85%. This is a different population than the patient with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, who with minimal activity is a steep and rapid decline to the high 70s. And they may be have no hypoxemia at rest. So they're different populations. And I think clinicians have to realize all exertional hypoxemia is not the same. This one took a little while to get down to 85%. It's a burden, right? You're going to ask her to take on this equipment, the costs. Does she live alone?
Yeah, that's my worry. I think we're seeing a lot more evidence that supplemental oxygen can contribute to social isolation. People don't want to leave the house because it becomes harder. Then I don't think there's been a study. Somebody should do this, but I am sure oxygen leads to more falls, right? Seems pretty obvious. There's this cords that you could trip over. It's heavy. People are not, you know, getting less exercise. So I think there definitely are a lot of downsides, but I don't know, Paul and Watto, if you ever feel like this, but it's kind of like, don't just stand there, do something. Like, it's something I could do, so maybe I should do it.
I will admit that I don't think I was taught until I might have learned this on the podcast that there's no, you know, mortality benefit for people with who just have exertional hypoxemia. Now, of course, fortunately, you've been doing this long enough. That was many years ago. So I'm less likely to try to get someone oxygen unless they have resting hypoxemia. Sometimes you do get the patient that really just wants oxygen. And I think that's because they feel breathlessness and they think it's going to really help that. How do you counsel people about breathlessness and like what actually does help it? I've heard about like, you know, just giving people just high flow, just air, or just putting a fan in their face can help, but.
That will help. I mean, you know, breathlessness is very complex. Every patient experiences it differently. You know, you can look at one patient, they're tachypneic, breathing rapidly, and ask, are they breathless? No, I'm okay. And the other patient, it's a very, you know, it's very individual. But in terms of how to treat breathlessness, I mean, our first role is to send them to pulmonary rehab if we can. And that's another conversation. So few patients are able to take advantage of that intervention. That intervention alone with a coached, incremental, individualized exercise and education program shows more symptom improvement than a lot of our medications, for at least for our fibrotic patients. They're different, obviously different goals there. So pulmonary rehab, even virtual programs now are you have to kind of be careful which ones they're referred to. Support groups, Better Breathers Clubs, American Lung Association. Social support is critical. I run a support group for our fibrotic patients, and I'll tell you, I could just like watch them because they're teaching each other how they manage all their oxygen issues, tips, and I learn a lot from patients. So Betty needs to manage breathlessness by being provided the resources for pulmonary rehab, which includes relaxation training, breathing retraining. Our speaker today for our support group was managing anxiety, you know, because that panic with breathlessness is profound. And this woman, you know, you have to remember she had an exacerbation. So this woman needs retesting as well. And I think that a lot of times we don't retest these types of patients and they're sitting with oxygen and Medicare paying for it and they're not using it. Or maybe they're using it, but they don't need it anymore. So follow up for her would be critical. I mean, she was hospitalized 2 months ago, still having more breathlessness. She may or may not improve more than this. This might be her new baseline, but it certainly would be nice to retest her. But she does need to be provided with those resources to deal with that breathlessness and understand what's causing the breathlessness and what can help and not help. Oxygen can do some, but there's no, you know, every patient benefits differently.
And so I guess what we're saying is it's not a clear decision that the patient would benefit from the oxygen in this situation, but we would have that conversation with them if this patient would qualify, so we could get it covered, but we would want to make sure that we're giving the appropriate counseling and what to expect from it.
I think what Susan said about that every patient is not the same is such a good point, because I think if this patient had ILD, I probably would start oxygen faster because I think it will accelerate faster, especially if it's IPF, right? Idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Then they get that really quick desaturation. And also patient preference, of course. And then if somebody has fallen like five times in the last month, then maybe we talk about how this could be quite risky for you.
Yeah. And getting the portable oxygen concentrator versus the E tanks or the D tanks, the smaller tanks filled with gas, like, is it hard to convince an insurance company to supply the portable oxygen concentrator, or is it just if the patient's willing to pay their portion out of pocket for that and their flow rate is low enough that they can get a portable concentrator?
So some of that depends on the DME, what equipment they carry. For example, some DMEs don't have POCs to offer, or their patients are waitlisted. POCs are not difficult, but they sometimes need replacing. And so the DMEs have told me that it's expensive, so they have to keep two POCs for every single patient. So they're sometimes hard to get. If they're available by that DME, there's no added cost. They're being provided their portable oxygen modality, and it should be the same. The patient should not be paying more because they're going to get either E-tanks or the POC. The DME is being reimbursed, and I would have to fact check that, but I think it's similar. They get set reimbursement, and they are to supply a stationary and a portable. And I must say, patients are sometimes surprised. They think they're just getting it to walk around with, and then they're like, oh my gosh, they delivered this huge box and this tubing, and do I need to use that? And it's like, well, if you're using it with sleep, you do, because we don't want patients using pulse dose systems during sleep, although there are some that are being used for sleep. And we don't want her tripping unnecessarily in the house. But, you know, this woman might need her oxygen at home when she's, you know, whatever she's doing inside the house or gardening outside, she may want that there. So I think the limiting factor has been the DME supply availability.
Can I ask both of you now, Paul, we talked a little bit about safety, the fall, like falling, and then the kind of the isolation thing you talked about, Leah. But what about patients who smoke? Like, you always worry about people blowing up their house. I don't know anyone who has blown up their house, but in your storied career, Susan, has someone blown up their house, or like, what? How do you talk to patients about that? How real is that fear?
It's real. Actually, a patient locally here, I don't know, they blew up the house, but there was a house fire and it was related to home oxygen she was using. And patients do get burns and such. So my focus is on interstitial lung disease patients. So in all honesty, I can't remember a patient that was smoking, and I'm not in the clinic as much as I was. In the COPD population, is that different? I don't know. I know at the VA, I believe they do not give oxygen to anyone smoking. I don't know, Leah. I mean, I it's so rare that I've dealt, but it's real. The risk is real.
It is rare.
Yes, yes.
It's rare. And I know that DME companies have them sign, of course, a liability form that promises they're not going to smoke. And that's something to counsel them about. I haven't seen it much, but I think burns are the biggest thing. I don't think home explosions are common.
But on that note, in terms of safety, Leah mentioned notifying or assigning the PG&E, one thing we do counsel all patients is to notify the fire department and the police department that they have oxygen in their home. So they will be put on in their electricity, the PG&E, they're put on a priority list. So if the power goes out in the area, they're a priority home to get power back on. And also if there's a fire, even in the neighborhood, you know, firemen want to know if they're walking into somewhere where there's 20 E-tanks in the garage because of the risk for explosion. So we do counsel patients for safety reasons and the loss of power, which is a big issue. The DME companies, there's no way they can supply backup oxygen when we have power outages here with fires and et cetera for days. So they need a backup plan. And I know patients, and again, you know, if patients have the finances to do so, they'll buy a portable generator. But that's really excludes patients that don't have that option. So they need a backup plan, and they do need to work, and they can notify their fire or police department. If they lose power, you can call them right away, and they can assist them as well. So it's very important to alert those both those departments when they get Then they start oxygen.
Mm-hmm. Should we go on to the last case, Leah?
Yeah, let's go to the last case. We're going to talk about travel, which I think comes up quite a lot, especially in primary care. So Inez, she's a 45-year-old woman with connective tissue disease, ILD. This happens all the time because we have a lot of mountains around around California. A recent trip to Lake Tahoe, or insert your local mountain range, she notices her oxygen saturation dropped to 88%. She is seeing you in your clinic at sea level, and she has no desaturation at rest or with vigorous ambulation, and you really try. She's got an upcoming flight to a high-altitude location, Denver, Colorado, and she asks for your advice on what to do. So a lot of our patients are asking how to prepare for travel on airplanes. What would you advise her in this situation?
She's in a tricky situation.
Yeah.
So we know that the airplanes are roughly around 5,000 to 8,000 feet. They're pressurized. So that we tell patients you're in altitude when you travel by plane. So she is stable otherwise. We're going to assume, you know, we want to look at cardiac, which is a big issue when we talk about flying, cardiac, any other comorbidities. So she won't qualify for oxygen. So that's the bottom line on a altitude only desaturation. I mean, I say that, I don't know if there's some DMEs that might rent her something, but in general, it's not covered by insurers. So her options are to rent. She can rent with a prescription, a portable oxygen concentrator to take on the plane. And she'd be a perfect candidate. That's not a significant drop. It's not cheap. I think it's $150 for a week. That's a ballpark, but that's the last time
that sounds right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's some outstanding travel companies, I must say. They will deliver you a POC overnight. So that's one. These are freestanding travel companies. And some of them provide very good service, and they will get it to you, and then you get it back. You can rent from your DME, but again, you don't know if they have one available. You may be waitlisted. So our mantra for travel is please plan way in advance, not only this type of patient who may have to rent one or get one from a local DME, but any patient who's traveling and needs oxygen, because there are innumerable forms online for each airline, and they're all different to fill out. They all have different things. Basically, what's the leader flow? Can the patient operate this? And you have to have 1.5 times the battery life of the hours of your flight. So if you're going back east from California, you would need 4-hour flight, 6 hours of battery. So that patient, we do advise all patients with travel to let us know and contact the airlines well in advance. But this is a very common, but it's a common scenario. So she was 88% at Tahoe, which is 6,000 feet.
Yeah.
I don't know if she was lakeside. I don't know where she was.
I know. I feel like this is such an area of clinical uncertainty too, and where it just really depends on the situation. Like maybe if she's going to Denver for like a week, I would probably say, you don't need to use supplemental oxygen. But if her second home was at altitude, I have told people, go get a walk test at a clinic there. Especially in a situation like this, where maybe I expect that she's going to continue to have more desaturation. So there's some ways to kind of work around it. But what about altitude simulation tests, which is a really niche thing that probably you can only get at a few academic medical centers? Are you prescribing these?
Yeah, we do that. And so that is a good option for a patient. Now, this patient knows she desaturates at that level, but we have patients, there are patients with chronic lung disease who are kind of on the borderline at sea level. So if they're 91% at rest, or even if they're desaturating with exertion, they already have oxygen. But if they don't qualify, but they are running around 90, 91% at sea level, they can be in the 80s, certainly at altitude. So we do high altitude simulation tests at Stanford, but it's not available everywhere. Do you anticipate that and have them rent a portable oxygen concentrator, especially if they have comorbidities? Are you worried about they have some cardiac issues? So high altitude simulation, they come in, they breathe in a diluted amount, so it's down to like 17% FiO2 instead of 21%. And then those results come back and the clinician determines what they recommend in terms of leader flow. And I've seen some fancy algorithms for calculating all that, but it's you would then assess what you think they need for flight.
I think that came up on a board exam question for me or a board study question. I don't think it was on my actual boards, but that was like the only time I heard of it. And I have not ordered it, but I have had some patients bring in forms for an airline before that I had to sign. And I didn't know the rental was available. I mean, that, I guess, for, again, you know, for patients, if $150 isn't a lot of money to them, they're going away for a week and they need it, you know, that seems achievable. But for some patients, that's not achievable, of course.
Yeah. You know, the other fear and concern that's real is that there's some what we call non-centrators that are being marketed online that are not FDA reviewed or approved. And patients find these and they're, you know, hundreds of dollars instead of thousands. And they're problematic. They don't deliver what they say. They purchase it and the website disappears. So we really include that in our education. Please don't purchase a POC unless you run it by us. And so that's, and we've actually in our ATS Oxygen Special Interest Group had a conversation with the FDA device group and have brought this to their attention because of the marketing, this with lack of oversight. So it's scary for those patients that buy something they think is delivering oxygen to them and it's not.
Well, good. Thank you for reporting that. And I hope the people, you know, I hope that people know not to buy. It's not, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. It sounds like it is in this case where spending 300 some dollars for a portable oxygen concentrator when they tend to cost, you told us earlier, $2,000 to $4,000 seems to be the out-of-pocket cost. Okay.
Yes.
Well, Leah, I think we're at the end. I don't know if you have any last minute questions or Paul, if there's anything we're missing.
No, I don't think so. I think we should move to take-home points. Susan, do you have any take-home points for our listeners?
I think the key challenge is educating our patients and the clinicians. But I think we hear so much confusion from patients about their equipment. It's frightening. The caregivers don't know what to do. Educating patients is a priority at the time they start oxygen therapy. And if that's just a one pager in the clinic that can be handed to them with a list of great resources, that's a start. I'm a huge supporter of pulmonary rehab. I know it's not accessible, but pulmonary rehab is like the best mix of every intervention that these patients need. Symptom management, education, social support, and most importantly, exercise. We want patients on oxygen to exercise. We don't want them to decrease their exercise so they don't need as much oxygen. We want them to enjoy life, be mobile, continue with whatever it is that they can enjoy for as long as they can. Making sure they bring their equipment with them to their clinic visits. Key pearl. You want to see what that patient's using and test them on that equipment because that's what's really going on. And the last education is understanding the difference between pulse flow and continuous flow. And that this is life-changing for the patient and their family. You know, the caregivers are underrepresented, appreciated, however you want to say it. They are with their family member or friend watching them, frightened they're going to run out. How do I change this tank? You know, dealing with it 100% alongside that patient. So it's a big change for patients. And I think as clinicians, we need to remember what we're asking of them and empathize with them.
Thank you so much, Susan. I wanted to add just a few more points of definitely prescribe oxygen when somebody has resting hypoxemia. A question mark, shared decision-making for people who desaturate with exertion or desaturate overnight. Shared decision-making based on patient factors and maybe the underlying disease. And really familiarize yourself with the devices and the nitty-gritty of prescribing, because it's just like inhalers. It's so important when you're talking to patients to understand how to actually use it. Susan, I'm wondering if you have anything to plug. You mentioned some legislative efforts.
Yes.
Maybe that's on your mind.
I would love to plug our SOAR Act. So I have chaired the Oxygen Special Interest Group of the American Thoracic Society since 2018. And it's been a very strong multidisciplinary collaborative effort to get improved care and services for our patients. So we now have a bill in the Senate and in the House. It's the Supplemental Oxygen Reform Act. Four pillars The first is that we're changing the word. The Medicare benefit is actually home oxygen. We're changing that to supplemental because we want patients out of the home. Secondly, it's ensuring access to liquid oxygen for those who benefit. So that subset of patients that are mobile out of the home and on high flow. It also provides for reimbursing respiratory therapists back into the DMEs. This was something that was also lost with reimbursement cuts. So we need that respiratory professional within the DME to educate our patients, test them on equipment. And then lastly, it includes some template type language so for reimbursement. So it's not a gray zone in terms of documentation. So we are really working hard. The leaders of this have been the American Lung Association, American Thoracic Society, American Association of Respiratory Care, Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, COPD, Pulmonary Hypertension, and many others. So please contact your legislators and tell them to co-sponsor. It's a very specific ask, not just support. They need to be a formal co-sponsor. We need as many co-sponsors as we can to get the SOAR Act passed by the end of the year. So that's our ask for on behalf of all of our patients.
Paul, this is the kind of politics that I feel comfortable getting into. This seems very, I'm fully behind all the things she just said there. This sounds like
very specific, nonpartisan,
very patient-centered legislation.
Yes.
I guess I'm saying, Paul, I'm for patient-centered legislation. That makes sense. You know, yeah. Common sense, patient-centered. This is great.
Coward.
Fantastic work. Did you call me a coward, Paul?
Yeah, I did.
Thank you. I am a coward. Okay. All right. Well, Susan, this has been so great. Thank you so much for all your time and teaching. And we will head into our outro.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole. Well, that was disappointing. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest that recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
You know, Leah, you've been working with us for like 7 years. I thought you were going to go for the yummy. So
sorry.
I was giving you space. It's fine.
I got distracted.
For the audio-only listeners, by the way, Watto taking a big sip of whatever out of his coffee mug, pretty yummy point. I wasn't sure this was going to be a spit take happening or if Leo was going to jump in, but you know, there's only so much time in the day.
It's hibiscus tea, Paul.
Fancy.
We're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback, so email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And a special thanks to our writers and producers for this episode, Dr. Leah Witt, Dr. Cyrus Askin, and Zoya Sarani. Thank you so much. And thank you to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpace. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Kristen Chumanchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
I've been Dr. Leah Witt.
And as always, our main Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.